welcome into the Doug Russell Podcast. Hope everyone's having a good wind-down week to the dumpster fire that was 2020. We're at the end of the calendar year, of course, the end of the regular season in the NFL. The College Football Bowl season is here. We've got some hot stove league action to talk about today. Mike Farron from MLB Radio is coming up later on in the show. But we do have to start with the Packers. Yes, they were dominant on Sunday Night Football.
First and goal from the 5-yard line. Good toss out to Adams, and Adams dives. Does he get in? He does. Touchdown. Boy, that was methodical. Third and one as we start the second quarter from the 21-yard line. Dillon stays in. The play fake to him, and then Rodgers will go for the touchdown and does. Equanimeous St. Brown for the touchdown. It's third down and four now. Pressure on Tannehill, but he hangs right in there and has it picked off at the 42-yard line by Darnell Savage. Darnell Savage is fourth of the season, and Green Bay in great shape with a 12-point lead and the ball in Tennessee territory. Packers want to make sure the road to the Super Bowl comes through Lambeau. And the throw into the end zone is hauled in by Adams for the touchdown. Devontae Adams got leverage. That time on Adoree Jackson. Six plays, 34 yards after the interception. Packers 18-0. Play action. Rodgers looking for his fourth touchdown pass of the night. Gets it. Third to Adams. Snap it. First down and a lot more, and all the way to the end zone goes A.J. Dillon. Fourth and inches, and off he goes for 30 yards and a touchdown. Meanwhile, getting into the end zone, yes sir, goes A.J. Dillon.
Al Michaels returning to the Sunday Night Football booth on NBC. The final score, the Packers clobber the Titans 40-14. Green Bay peaking at the right time of the season. A.J. Dillon doing what he was drafted for and maybe put the final death knell into the future of Aaron Jones in a Packers uniform for 2021 and beyond. Look, if Aaron Jones can get a good deal somewhere else, I think that he should take it. I was asked earlier this week whether or not I thought that A.J. Dillon's emergence on Sunday Night Football, that spelled the end of Aaron Jones. I don't think that's what spelled the end of Aaron Jones. I think when he fired his agent and hired Drew Rosenhaus, that probably spelled the end of Aaron Jones in Green Bay. I know that David Bakhtiari's contract, which at the time was described as one that was flexible enough for the Packers to move this, that, or the other thing around to make Aaron Jones's contract work in Green Bay, that's all well and good, but I feel like still they had to make a decision between Bakhtiari and Jones. And in my mind, they made the proper decision, and that's not a knock on Aaron Jones at all. Aaron Jones is one of the best people you're ever going to encounter in professional sports. And like I said, if he gets a better offer somewhere else from another team, and I suspect that he will, he should take it because I think the Packers are a little bit flush at that position, especially if A.J. Dillon can continue to do something similar. He's not going to get 140-plus yards every time he goes out and suits up for the Packers. I don't think anybody expects that of A.J. Dillon, including A.J. Dillon. But what A.J. Dillon was drafted for and in the second round to do was to be that bruising running back that the Packers didn't have. The Packers already have someone who's somewhat similar to Aaron Jones in Jamal Williams. The difference between Jones and Williams is that Williams isn't going to cost as much as Jones. And again, Aaron Jones, whatever he gets out on the open market this upcoming offseason, he's earned it. And he should take it. And he should feel like he deserves it, because he does. No ill will toward Aaron Jones, even if he goes, you know, to the Vikings or the Bears or anything like that. And no Packers fan should think ill of him no matter where he winds up going. Because, again, the shelf life of a running back in the NFL, as everyone knows, is so incredibly short. So that's what I think probably is going to happen this offseason. Aaron Jones is going to get a big money contract to go somewhere else. And and he should take it. In the meantime, the Packers are going to not only use Dylan, but they're also going to use Aaron Jones while they have him. This might be potentially the last best opportunity for the Packers to make a Super Bowl run with Aaron Rodgers as your quarterback. And, you know, as we talked about with Kevin Holden from CBS 58, you know, nobody's talking about Jordan Love right now. Nobody should be talking about Jordan Love right now because of the incredible season that Aaron Rodgers is having. And if you go back to this past Sunday, you know, Patrick Mahomes was okay. Aaron Rodgers was spectacular. I suspect that unless that's a complete reversal of fortune coming up this weekend, you're going to see Aaron Rodgers win his third NFL MVP award. Patrick Mahomes, I suspect, will win three at some point. He's already got one. I don't think he's going to get number two this year, but I do suspect that at some point he's not only going to pick up number two, but also number three and maybe number four. He's that special of a talent. But I think this year is Aaron Rodgers' year to win another NFL MVP award. All right, so what all of this does is it sets up this final NFL Sunday. So here's where we're at. The Packers take on the Bears on Sunday, 3:25 Wisconsin time kickoff from Soldier Field. You can watch the game, by the way, on CBS. Here are the Packers' scenarios for clinching the first round bye. It's pretty simple. If the Packers win, they're the number one seed. That's it. No other scenario. If they win, it's theirs. Also, if Seattle loses, or ties, but if Seattle loses their game against San Francisco, irrespective of what the Packers do, the Packers are the top seed in the NFC. So it's pretty simple for Green Bay. It gets a little muddy for everyone else. It doesn't matter, by the way, what the Saints do, because the Saints are 11-4, the Packers are 12-3, and the Packers hold the number one tiebreaker, the head-to-head from week three, as we all know. For what it's worth, the Saints are at Carolina on Sunday, a 3:25 kickoff. The Saints can clinch the first round bye if both they win and the Packers and Seahawks lose. So it is an important game for the Saints. But again, the Packers have to take care of their business. As far as the Seahawks, as I mentioned, they take on San Francisco. Seattle would clinch the first round bye with a win, plus a Packers loss, plus a Saints loss as well. So while the Packers hold the head-to-head tiebreaker against the Saints, the Seahawks hold the head-to-head tiebreaker the Seahawks hold it over the Saints. So again, Seattle at San Francisco, New Orleans at Carolina, Green Bay at Chicago, all three of those games, by decree of the NFL, are now going to start at the same time. They're all 3:25 kickoffs, so there's not going to be any kind of inherent advantage or disadvantage for any of those three teams that are jockeying for the top three places in the NFC. Now, as for the Packers' opponents, it's not going to be an easy game for the Packers because the Bears are playing for their playoff lives. Chicago clinches a playoff berth with a win or an Arizona loss, or if they both tie. So if the Bears win, they're in. If Arizona loses, Chicago is in. If they both tie, then Chicago gets the tiebreaker there. So right now, your number one seed, of course, is the Packers. Your second seed is the Saints, followed by Seattle. Washington is your number four seed, despite their current 6-9 record. But because they're leading the NFC East right now, they would get the number four seed over any of the wild card teams, despite the fact that Tampa Bay's record is four games better right now than Washington's. So also Washington would get the home game as the number four seed in the first round of the playoffs. The number six seed right now, the Los Angeles Rams, and the number seven seed, the Chicago Bears. The teams that are still alive, it's a flickering hope, but there are two teams that are still hanging in there. And that's the Cardinals and the Cowboys. Arizona is 8-7. The Cowboys are 6-9. But also Dallas is the only reason they're alive is because they're in the putrid NFC East. As far as the AFC, don't want to spend a whole lot of time on the AFC. But suffice it to say, Kansas City last week, even though it was a squeaker against Atlanta, they still won that game. They're still 14-1. They did not look dominant, but Right now, they've got a two-game lead over Buffalo with one game left to play. What does that mean? It means that Kansas City has clinched the top seed no matter what happens this weekend. I would suspect that you're not going to see very many starting Chiefs players play this weekend because they've got bigger fish to fry in a couple of weeks. You might see Patrick Mahomes come out there just to get a couple of reps, just to make sure that he doesn't get too rusty or anything like that. But you're not going to see a whole lot of him, I suspect, for Kansas City this weekend. The rest of their playoff picture looks like this. Your number two seed, the Buffalo Bills. They've had an incredible season. Your number three seed right now is the Pittsburgh Steelers. They both are 12-3, but Buffalo wins the tiebreaker over Pittsburgh based on head-to-head win percentage. The Tennessee Titans right now, the number four seed, but there's a lot of bunching up in there right now as well. Tennessee, Miami, and Baltimore, and Cleveland, and Indianapolis, all 10-5 right now. But it goes in this order: Tennessee, Miami, Baltimore, and Cleveland. And here's why. And again, I apologize for this being a little bit granular, but Tennessee is your number four seed right now based on their best winning percentage in division games over Indianapolis. Miami wins the tiebreak over Indianapolis and Baltimore based on best winning percentage in conference games. The division tiebreak was initially used to eliminate Cleveland, but Baltimore wins the break over Cleveland, the tiebreak over Cleveland, based on head-to-head winning percentage. Also, Baltimore, your number six seed, they win the tiebreak over Indianapolis based on head-to-head winning percentage. The division tiebreak was initially used to eliminate Cleveland, as we mentioned before, but Baltimore wins that tiebreak over Cleveland based on the head-to-head against those two teams. Right now, the Browns are the number seven seed. They're 10-5. They might be bounced out of the playoffs, but right now, they win the tiebreaker over Indianapolis based on head-to-head. The Colts right now, 10-5. They may be out of the playoffs based on what happens this weekend. That's what's going on in the AFC. There's a lot going on, really, this weekend. But here are the games. Some have more meaning than others. Miami is at Buffalo, an important game for the Dolphins. Baltimore is at Cincinnati, an incredibly important game for the Ravens. Pittsburgh is at Cleveland, important for both teams. Also, you've got the Dallas Cowboys and the New York Giants. That's an important game for Dallas. They're still alive. Atlanta is at Tampa Bay, an important game for Tampa Bay. Also, you've got Arizona at Los Angeles taking on the Rams, an incredibly important game for the Arizona Cardinals and for the Rams for that matter as well. As I mentioned, Kansas City, not an important game for them, not an important game for their opponents, the Los Angeles Chargers, but just kind of keep an eye on what the reps are that Patrick Mahomes has this weekend as well. We've already mentioned a couple of the other games as well, including Seattle at San Francisco. New Orleans is at Carolina. The only other game that really has a lot of meaning is Washington at Philadelphia, because the Washington football team, they can wind up winning their division if they win over the Eagles on Sunday. So that's it. We're down to week 17. This is the last weekend of the regular season. After this, there are no more playoff scenarios. We will know what the playoffs look like on Monday. We'll also know exactly what the Packers' path to the Super Bowl in Tampa Bay is going to be. Is it going to run through Lambeau Field? I heard this statistic earlier today, and I was stunned by it. Aaron Rodgers, in his playoff career, has played 19 playoff games. That didn't stun me. I knew that. Only six of them, though, have been at Lambeau Field. And when you think about it, the great playoff triumphs of Aaron Rodgers' career, and even, you know, many of the more memorable games of his playoff career haven't happened at Lambeau Field. Most of them haven't. Last year, they beat Seattle at Lambeau Field, and then in the NFC Championship game had to travel to San Francisco, where they lost to the 49ers. When the Packers won the Super Bowl back in the 2010 season, they had to go on the road three straight weeks: Philadelphia, Atlanta, and then Chicago, because they were the number six seed in the playoffs and got hot at the right time. The next year, like Kansas City, so far this season, the Packers only lost once that entire regular season. They were 15-1 going into the playoffs. And there was a prevailing thought that, you know what, Aaron Rodgers was having the best year of his career. The Packers were coming off a Super Bowl championship where they didn't really seem like they had any drop-off. And, you know, they had a five-game improvement in the regular season from the year they won the Super Bowl to the next season, from 2010 to 2011. And what happened. They go into the divisional round of the playoffs. The playoffs were supposed to run through Lambeau Field. The Packers had clinched home field throughout. They got that first round bye, and they lay an egg against the New York Giants. And good for the New York Giants. I mean, they wound up winning the Super Bowl that year over the New England Patriots in Arizona, but it doesn't mean just because you have the number one seed that you automatically have a smooth path to the Super Bowl. That's not how it works. And we've seen that. And I think it's more anecdotal than not that it happened to happen because of the Packers and after their incredible season that they had in 2011. But their defense was awful. And the Giants exploited that. And just shows that when the playoffs roll around, it's an entirely different kind of ball game. The Packers showed it both ways, both in 2010 and in 2011. So that's what the playoff scenarios look like right now. As for this week, here's the bottom line. As we said a week ago here on the podcast, Sunday's game against the Bears is critical. Chicago is playing better football than they were earlier in the season. They've put up, in their last five games, they've put up 30-plus points. The Seahawks have been playing good football, important because they take on the 49ers. And even though the 49ers are an injury-depleted team, they're a team that's no pushover. But Seattle certainly is favored, and they should be favored, against San Francisco coming up on Sunday. The Bears have everything to play for. The Bears are going to treat this game on Sunday like it's their playoff game, because in essence it is. Because if they win, they're in. If they win, they advance. Arizona, they've got to win and have the Bears lose. Arizona is at Los Angeles coming up on Sunday. So that game will be going on right when the Packers-Bears game is going to be going on as well. I hear a lot of confidence. Confidence is great, but from Packers fans specifically this week, bordering on cockiness at times. Don't take this game for granted if you're a Packers fan. Don't think that the Bears are going to roll over because they're the Bears. Again, they're playing for their playoff lives. They've been playing much better football in the last month than they were the month prior to that. December's been good to them. November was not. But the Packers have had a lot of success at Soldier Field. Here's where I will caution you. The 2010 NFC Championship game, forget that it ever happened. The last game of the 2013 season, when Aaron Rodgers found Randall Cobb and caught Chris Conte sleeping, that was great, right? That was a lot of fun. Eliminated the Bears. Packers went into the playoffs as the division champions that day. You have to forget that that ever happened. Those games were great, but they have absolutely nothing to do with this week's Packers game. The Packers have to play a similar game to the one that they had against the Titans last week. That's it. What they did on Sunday Night Football at Lambeau against Tennessee, that's what they have to do again at Soldier Field. I'm not saying they have to win 40-14. I am saying that Aaron has to be great again. I'm saying A.J. Dillon has to be good. Aaron Jones, Devontae Adams, the line. Getting Corey Linsley back was fantastic this past week. Darnell Savage, Jaire Alexander, the rest of the secondary. They have to be good against Mitchell Trubisky on Sunday. You cannot take anything for granted. This is a very important game for the Packers. Everyone's got to be up because of what's on the line. We'll have a lot more to say about this on Friday, about this one and some of the other games that will impact the upcoming NFC playoffs. But again, I want to caution Packers fans, do not sleep this week on the Chicago Bears. The Badgers play their bowl game on Wednesday morning. Don't want to dwell on it too much. It's the Mayonnaise Bowl, after all. But it's still a bowl game. in a season that's been such a disappointment in so many ways. Here's head coach Paul Chryst.
We've appreciated the way our guys have approached the bowl prep, and you know, it's been good to this point, and then looking forward to playing and against a very good Wake Forest team and get another opportunity to play. So certainly looking forward to it. I think they found a way to bond with each other and kind of help each other through it. Some guys handle that better than others. Some are, kind of comfortable in that a little bit more naturally, and others truly need to be around people. So it's, I think for each guy, it's been different, but it's I don't think it's ever easy. It's a great lesson for many because, if you approach it and put the work in, when opportunity does come your way, you will be as prepared as you can be, where I think some people and maybe parts of human nature are that, they're kind of waiting for their opportunity and then they'll put the work in. And for many, it's too late then. When you're playing well, it comes down to fundamentals that you could cross over to any conference, any team. But then absolutely, there's a, when you watch a whole season, there are differences. And I think that is one of the things that makes it fun when you're playing good teams from other conferences.
Coach Paul Chryst, his quarterback, Graham Mertz, he'll get his first ever bowl game start.
Yeah, obviously you want to win the game. And it's always fun. You get to play for a trophy. And for us, it's another trophy game. And in the end, you want to be holding something up. So that's all we're worried about right now is winning this one. It's always good to get guys back and just kind of get into the swing of things. So it's definitely been good. It's good when you got more guys on the offense. That's always a good thing. Once we get down the season, I can take a step back and then get a little cut up of all my completions, and then try to map out my off-season training plan. So definitely there's always stuff to learn, always stuff that you got to grow on and adapt. So it'll be a really, really good off-season.
Badgers quarterback Graham Mertz. Kickoff is at 11 o'clock Wisconsin time. In Milwaukee, you can listen to the game on The Game, 97.3 FM. You can also watch the game on ESPN. To baseball, where the hot stove is heating up, the Padres are making some moves. They add ace Blake Snell in a trade with the Rays. They also add Yu Darvish in a deal with the Cubs. They also add Korean star Ha Sung Kim for at least 4 years and roughly $25 million. All of that happened after my conversation with MLB Radio's Mike Farron that aired first on SportsMap Radio. It may be Christmas time, but that means more than just good basketball games and presents under the tree. It means that the days are actually, yes, believe it or not, starting to get a little bit longer. The calendar is going to turn soon in about a week or so, and then we're going to start counting down the days until pitchers and catchers report. The hot stove is heating up. So what exactly is MLB cooking up? Joining us now on the Progressive Insurance guest line here on SportsMap Radio, he is one of the hosts of MLB Radio on Sirius XM. We welcome in Mike Farron here on SportsMap Radio. Mike, Merry Christmas to you. Thanks for joining me today. I want to start here, and I realize that this is a little bit crystal balling it, but what's your gut feeling about how this season is going to play out off the field in the way that labor and management deal with each other?
Oh, boy, that's a loaded one to start with, Doug. I don't know that I have a great feel. I think here are the issues that we're dealing with in the most immediate present. There are questions, obviously, as to the safety of having fans in the stands at most ballparks. Most owners would like to play as few games, read that as no games with no fans, because of the loss of revenue from season to go. And they also don't want to put fans in the situation where they're having to make health decisions as to whether or not they want to come to the ballpark. So, the easiest way to get that to happen is to have a vaccine available to the vast majority of people in the U.S., which is still several months away, and probably beyond what opening day is currently scheduled for on April 1st. From the player side, they are contracted to play 162 games in their collective bargaining agreement. Last year, they gave away 63% of their income as part of the agreement with Major League Baseball, and so they would like to be able to retain that. I realize that what they're talking about are numbers that are significantly higher than what most of us, not you, but what most of us are making in a given year. But it's still, there is a principle to the matter as well. And while they are concerned about their own health and safety and how a vaccine might be available to them, they also would like to be paid for what they are contracted to be paid for. And so this is where the battle comes in. And, you know, personally, I think if you were to take the money issue out of it, which I realize you can't do, but if you were to do it, I think it would be the safest to not start on April 1st and probably start closer to or into May. Now, can you do that and still play 162 games? Potentially. Can you do that and you get the Players Association to agree to a reduction in terms of the number of games this season? Maybe. But I think that's where a lot of this battle is going to come, and probably over the next few weeks, because we are less than 2 months away from when pitchers and catchers are scheduled to report, and we don't know what that's going to mean as of yet. I mean, as of right now, everybody is working on the working towards pitchers and catchers report date around the middle of February, but we feel like that there is a good chance in the next couple of weeks that something changes in that regard.
Do you think there's going to be a universal designated hitter when everything is settled, when all the dust does finally, you know, hit the ground?
Probably, but it's really hard to try and guess on that. I think anything that was in place for last year from rules on the field, whether it be that expanded rosters, which probably makes sense in this season, seeing as, again, they played just more than a third of the year last year, or a third of a schedule normal year, you know, whether it's the extra inning rule with a man on second, or the 7-inning doubleheaders, those are all things that need union approval. And maybe they get that done and with the owners, and the owners would like expanded playoffs too. You know, if maybe that all gets done beforehand, but I would think it's going to be much closer to spring training or to even opening day before any of those rules kind of coalesce. There's an awful lot on the plate right now just in trying to, you know, if in fact there is this, you know, huge divide between what the players want and what ownership wants, there's a huge divide in trying to get that filled in and trying to get that done in time for a season. And so I think it's probably more of a back burner issue. Now, as is the collective bargaining agreement, which expires December 1st of next year. So, I mean, this is just like one giant looming issue with collective bargaining here,
which we'll dive into in just a second. But on a personal note, Mike, I mean, I mentioned the universal designated hitter. We saw that in the National League, obviously, last year. You mentioned the extra inning rules, the 7-inning doubleheaders. What did you think of the rule changes that were put into place specifically for the shortened season a year ago?
Yeah, I mean, I actually really love the 7-inning doubleheader rule. They've done that for years in the minor leagues. I think it's a great way to go about things. I think, you know, it gets you two games without having quite the grind or the amount of hours spent, you know, locked in on a game. I mean, I love it. Like, I really like that one. The universal DH, I mean, you know me, I've always been a National League guy, so I don't mind the pitcher hitting as much as some other people do, but I've been resigned to the fact that that's coming in. I certainly have heard enough from players and managers that they liked the extra inning rule because it prevented some of those long grind games, you know, where you're going 15, 16, 17 innings, and they don't happen all that often, but they do affect a roster for numerous days. So I think all of those things were relatively positive. And I actually like the three-batter minimum. That's one we know is going to stay because that was in the rules before the pandemic struck. I like that. What I'm curious, too, is whether or not one of the roster rules that they had last year, remember they were supposed to have 26-man rosters, but a limit of 13 pitchers. And I think going forward, a limit on pitchers on the roster is really important because I think it helps to reduce the number of pitching changes you have in a game potentially, which can take out some of the dead time in the action or from the action.
Mike Farren joining us from MLB Radio on Sirius XM. He appears on the Progressive Insurance guest line here on Sports Map Radio. You mentioned the collective bargaining agreement, which we're now less than a year away from it expiring. the relationship between Tony Clark and Rob Manfred doesn't seem as strong as maybe the relationship, I don't know, that Bud Selig had with Michael Wiener, for example, who tragically passed away after a bout with brain cancer, and then Tony Clark took over as the head of the Players Association. It just doesn't seem as though there's that same respect, relationship, trust, whatever you want to call it, between those two. Can they bridge whatever their gap is and avoid a work stoppage, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, they have. So, I mean, I think they certainly can again. I mean, they've done one collective bargaining agreement together. And you know, no, Michael Wiener was somebody that was that Rob Manfred had a great deal of respect for. And they worked together. You know, he was the chief negotiator for Major League Baseball for a long time. So they worked very well together. Tony's got a little bit different priority, just in the sense that, you know, he's a former player. And so he might actually be better in tune to some degree with some of the needs of players and whatnot. But I think that there definitely is a chance. I mean, I think they were able to negotiate a couple of different agreements, no matter how difficult it was to watch it play out publicly and how much it felt like it was pulling teeth. They were able to get a couple of deals done. So I think that that's entirely possible. And I do think, you know, and this is just one thing I would say in general, when we listen to stories about the negotiations for collective bargaining, from what I understand, and I've never been, you know, I'm not an attorney, I don't even play one on the radio, and I've never been a part of a union or an ownership negotiation group or management negotiation group in this. But from what I understand, collective bargaining is an extremely contentious negotiation to begin with. And so having the two sides quibbling with each other over major and minor issues is not really all that unusual. And I think we are probably pretty poorly equipped as a baseball media to be able to cope with that, to be able to deal with you know, what we see with these quibbles, because it's not something we're used to. We're used to covering games and you know, personal stories on players and management and owners and all that. And so we don't necessarily have the necessary experience to understand that. But just because you hear the two sides squabbling or fighting or walking away from the table, you know, over the course of the summer, doesn't mean something isn't going to get done, because that's just what happens in collective bargaining.
Mike Farron from MLB Radio on Sirius XM joining us here on Sports Map Radio. I want to change gears because there's still a lot of free agents, as you know, that are out there. Obviously, the big names, Trevor Bauer, JT Realmuto, George Springer, among them. In past years, it seems as though their deals may have already been done at this point. Do you think that January, and maybe even February, will become the quote-unquote new December as it pertains to big free agent signings in years to come?
Well, I certainly think it's the case this year, and John Mozeliak, the president of the Cardinals, said that a couple weeks ago, that January is the new December. Last year, it really wasn't the case. I mean, most of the major deals were done in December, although we have seen a fair amount of major deals done in January and February over the last decade plus. So, you know, it's not all that unusual. I think what's driving this is more, maybe more certainty in terms of what revenues are going to look like from the ownership side, and therefore what budgets will look like for baseball operations departments. And also more certainty on when exactly the season starts. That those are all things that tie together. And that, I think, is where that why we're seeing so big a delay into January. And not to mention, you know, it's not, I mean, it's a decent free agent class, and there are some really good players. I mean, JT Realmuto is the best all-around catcher. George Springer is a tremendous two-way player. Trevor Bauer is an immensely talented pitcher and you know, the winner of the National League Cy Young Award last year. And, you know, when you've got number of big market teams that aren't necessarily sure how much they can spend, it does tend to slow things down. And I think there's another part of this, especially when it comes to the position players, is next winter's class is pretty loaded, including five really quality shortstops that are all going to be in their mid to late 20s. I mean, it's Francisco Lindor, Trevor Story, Javier Baez, Carlos Correa, and Corey Seager as it stands right now. So I think all of those things are probably factoring into this. I don't know that it's going to be the case that this is it going forward. And as a talk show host, I really don't mind it too much, because it gives us something to talk about in January, which used to be a really slow month. But you would like to see, you know, just like everything in baseball, we could use the pace to pick up just a little bit.
Mike Farron from MLB Radio on Sirius XM joining us here on the Progressive Insurance Guest Line on Sports Map Radio. Mike, great to catch up with you. I could talk baseball for hours with you. You know that. Always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for coming on Sports Map Radio.
Great to be with you, Doug. Merry Christmas.
MLB Radio's Mike Farron, that interview airing first on Sports Map Radio a few days ago. Finally today, a dust up on the social medias where Rick Carl has made a name for himself, not necessarily in a great way, but who is Rick Carl, you might ask? Well, he's a news and former sports reporter on WVTM-TV in Alabama. Tuscaloosa is one of his markets. And he's taking issue with his media colleagues in a Facebook rant that's gone somewhat viral. I won't read the whole thing. He begins it with, "Dear my media brethren," and his first paragraph is rather patronizing, saying, you know, "I'm one of you. I understand everything's hectic. 2020 has been bad. Yay." And then he goes on to say, "But something's been eating me well for about 13 years. And it came to light again today as I listened to Coach Saban's pre-Rose Bowl news conference, which was held virtually today as the coach fielded questions from across America while he was stationed in Tuscaloosa. You see, I have a problem with reporters addressing Coach Saban as Nick when asking the coach a question if they don't know him well. I have heard this since the coach arrived in Tuscaloosa in 2007. Questions like, Nick, can you tell me about the progression of your quarterback? Or, Nick, what have you learned about your team this year? Today, I even heard a young reporter get on the call and start her question with, Hi, Saban. Yes, it could have been nerves from a young reporter. Completely understood if it was. As we've all been in that position, I know the coach can be intimidating. I've come up with a proposal for all of us media people to follow as we move into a new year. How about simply calling the head football coach at the University of Alabama, Coach Saban? I think the man has earned that much respect. And then he goes on and on and on about who can call Nick Saban Nick. Who in my eyes can call Coach Saban Nick? Miss Terry can. Miss Terry is Nick Saban's wife. I'm going to circle back around to that in a second. Lifelong friends can. His current assistants can. I would question that. Perhaps a few in the media world can call him Nick. Chris Lowe, Cecil Hurt, perhaps Feinbaum, Reese Davis, or Tom Rinaldo. You know, people who know him well. But the last time I checked, none of the above are any of us. Think about it. Why does almost every person in our state refer to Paul Bear Bryant as Coach Bryant? It's respect. Calling him any other name than Coach Bryant is showing disrespect. And then he goes on and says that that's what Nick Saban has earned. Okay, a couple of things about that. I am generally loath to go media on media crime. It's not my thing, really. And what Rick Carlisle is talking about really is kind of a Southern thing. It's kind of silly, honestly. You know, occasionally, if it's an outrageous or an uninformed take, I'll maybe tear into Skip Bayless for a myriad of things. Colin Cowherd has had some whoppers over the years as well. But generally, I try to stay away from media on media crime. But this whole respect, disrespect thing, whatever. Look, my biggest problem with Rick Carl's soliloquy is that it came off really old white man lectury. Calling someone by their first name is generally not a sign of disrespect if everyone's an adult. Okay. And calling someone coach or calling someone by their first name, again, it's a cultural thing. I'll give you an example. I spoke earlier today with Buffalo head football coach Lance Leipold. Now, I've known Lance Leipold for well over a decade. He, of course, won 6 national championships at Division III Wisconsin Whitewater. He and I have broken bread together. We have stayed in touch over the years. I can shoot him a text. He can shoot me a text any day of the week just to check in and say hello. And I spoke with him earlier today. Lance Leipold, again, has won 6 national championships. To me, he's Lance. I still call him coach occasionally. We're going to have him, I think, on either SportsMap Radio or on this podcast or over on 97.3 The Game, or maybe a combination of all of them, hopefully sooner rather than later. And I will go back and forth. I'll call him Coach. I'll call him Lance. I'll call him Coach. I'll call him Lance. But I'm, again, I respect Lance Leipold. I don't feel it necessary to call him Coach Leipold at all times. To me, he's Lance. He's my friend Lance. But, you know, I don't think that he demands that from anyone else. And I knew that this was going to be a cultural touchstone when Rick Carl called Nick Saban's wife Miss Terry. Well, if Miss Terry can call him Nick. He telegraphed where he was coming from. He's coming from the Deep South. We have so many cultural divides in this country right now. Don't let this be one of them. If I have a gentle pushback on Rick Carl, and again, I'm not going to pile on him. He's gotten so much grief on social media, specifically on Twitter. There's been a lot of pushback, and I think that he probably knew that there was going to be some pushback that was coming, and I'm not going to be one of the ones that's going to, you know, shovel dirt on him or anything like that, because I don't care that much. All I would say is don't tell other people how to act. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants to be told how to do their job if they're a professional. And it's not unprofessional to call someone by their first name, unless you're talking about the president of the United States. And I know that there's a great divide about, you know, those who voted for President-elect Biden, those who voted for President Trump. I will always call the president of the United States Mr. or Ms. or Madam, Mr. or Madam President, no matter, you know, what political affiliation they or I have. Beyond that, we don't have titles in the United States. We just don't. We are a more informal people than we used to be. And I think that that's a good thing. I think it breaks down more barriers. Nick Saban may have a lot more money than I do. He may have a lot more championships than I do. He's got a lot more fame than I do. But that doesn't mean that he's a better person than I am, that Rick Carl is, or that anybody else is. We're all just people. Don't let this be one of the things that divides us. If we've learned anything in 2020, I hope it's this. Don't sweat the small stuff. And this is about as small as it could possibly get. That's it for today. I leave you with that. We will see you here on Thursday on the Doug Russell Podcast. It's our final show of 2020. Have a great day, everybody.